From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After weeks delaying the move, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi may send articles of impeachment to the Senate this week. Could a Senate trial be far behind? Presidential candidate Cory Booker announced he's dropping out of the 2020 race as the Democrats debate again this week. And into the mix this week, mixed messages about why the U.S. killed a top Iranian general, triggering a cascade of events. Lots to talk about this Monday morning with NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
So start with the articles of impeachment. We're expecting Speaker Pelosi to send those to the Senate next couple of days. Just briefly, is that still on track?
So that is very possible. We could see those articles of impeachment moved as early as Tuesday, is our understanding. There's a caucus meeting that morning for her party, and she could name House managers, who is the prosecution team that will present the case in the Senate, and they could do these articles and move them that evening, as early as that evening.
So this could pick up speed. Look, she's been criticized for taking this long, though. And yesterday on ABC's This Week, she defended her approach. Let's listen.
I've always said I would send them over, so there shouldn't be any mystery to that. What we did want, though, and we think we accomplished in the past few weeks, is that we wanted the public to see the need for witnesses with firsthand knowledge of what happened.
Well, they did. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton emerged to say he wants to testify. Republicans have been saying no firsthand knowledge, and he has that. Can they really not call him to testify?
That's very possible. Senate Republicans have been very strong, for the most part, led by McConnell, that they are not as interested in calling these witnesses. Now, there is a group of Republicans, including Maine Senator Collins, who is working, she said, with a small group of members and looking at the potential of calling some witnesses. And this could be through a deposition. This may not be witnesses testifying live in the chamber. But it's very possible, though, with some senators pushing for no witnesses, that we don't see any, but that all remains to be seen.
Yeah, I want to switch gears for a second and go to the White House's changing rationale for the killing of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. President Trump telling Fox News on Friday he took the action because there was an imminent threat of four U.S. embassies being attacked. Yesterday, though, Defense Secretary Mark Esper had this exchange with CBS Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan when asked directly about this intelligence of an imminent attack.
Well, the president didn't say it was a tangible. He didn't cite a specific piece of evidence. What he said is he believed.
Are you saying there wasn't one?
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies. What I'm saying is I share the president's view that probably my expectation was they were going to go after our embassies.
Well, this morning the president tweeted out, imminent doesn't matter. You know, this general had a really bad history. It's just hard to hear a defense secretary say, I didn't see the evidence, but I shared his view possibly. How's this going over?
Yes, it's been a very confusing and shifting message that's come from the administration, from the president to his top officials such as Mark Esper. It's hard to keep track of the reasoning that fueled this attack, and it's causing a lot of confusion. What was behind this? The four embassies, that detail, that wasn't in the intel. Esper made that clear, and now Trump is shifting away from saying, you know, imminent is not as critical here. So it's making this a very confusing conversation to follow.
Well, I'm wondering, Claudia, you've got your ear to the ground there. Republicans have been burned before by false information leading to war, the weapons of mass destruction that were not there, that led to the war in Iraq that some say is still a part of this, you know, cascade of events. I mean, what are you hearing from Republicans in particular?
Well, there are some Republicans that are speaking out in the Senate, Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Mike Lee in particular, he left a briefing last week really frustrated with the details they weren't able to obtain related to this attack and concerns that they were being misled as to the reasoning behind what fueled the killing of this Iranian general. So other Republicans are still defending the president, but there is some concern among some of their members.
We just have a few seconds here, but New Jersey Senator Cory Booker out. Do you think he's completely out of the picture, or might he be on the radar as a second?
I think we could see him again. He showed a lot of potential during this run. It does leave a less diverse group behind for the Democrats, but I think we'll see more of Cory Booker in the future again.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
People in Iran are protesting their government after the country admitted to shooting down that Ukrainian jetliner last week, killing everyone on board. Iran had initially denied shooting down the plane before changing its story. The downing of that plane came after Iran fired missile strikes against bases in Iraq where there were American troops. And that action was in retaliation to the U.S. drone strike that killed Iran's top military commander, who was in Baghdad at the time. Borzu Daragahi is an international correspondent for The Independent. He joins us from Istanbul. And Borzu, describe the reaction in Iran to the admission that it shut down this Ukrainian airplane.
I think first you have to kind of understand who was on this plane. These were not like average humdrum people. These were people mostly who were graduates, many of them, of the most elite and prestigious universities in Iran. In a certain circle in Tehran especially, this, you know, is just causing a massive wave of grief across a very large swath of people, of and influential people, and so on. And you can see that the regime is rather frightened and flustered, a little bit intimidated by the wave of grief that has been engulfing the quarter of the country that's affected by this.
Yeah, we're seeing lots of photos and video of people out in the streets. What are people asking from the government?
They're asking the government to show some more accountability. They're asking for resignations and prosecutions, real explanations. But I think it's also sort of fused with, you know, persistent anger and anti-regime sentiment that has been prevalent for years now. And so I think that, you know, what you're seeing is a lot of, you know, grief, of course, a lot of anger at the government, but, you know, a lot also of people just not wanting the regime and seeing this as an opening to retake control of the political narrative in the country after the sort of surge of nationalism and pro-regime sentiment that followed the U.S. assassination of IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani.
Asking for resignations, are they also asking for the resignation of the supreme leader?
I think that there's a certain portion of the Iranian population that includes and straddles over the people who are angry about this plane crash that would definitely like the resignation of the supreme leader. But I don't think that anyone has specifically called for that. They've called for the death of the supreme leader, but I haven't heard anyone saying, you know, we want him to resign. They just want him gone.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the discontent. I mean, all of us were watching late last year when thousands of Iranians took to the street in those nationwide anti-government protests that were sparked by high gas prices. Can you put this in even more context for us, how these particular protests are connected to that?
They're not. And that's part of the problem. And you can see the way that the government handled those protests. Which were largely lower middle class and poorer people in ethnic parts of the country, i.e. Arab and Kurdish. And the regime opened fire on them and killed anywhere from 300 to 1,500. Now, you know, when it comes to this particular crowd of protesters, the elite, the regime is treating them with somewhat kid gloves, you know. Yes, there's been a couple reports of shootings and so on, but by and large, the response has been restrained. No kind of ferocious gunfire and so on against these kids. You never know whose kid they could be killing. It could be the son or daughter of one of the regime elites.
It's worth mentioning that the U.S. Navy shot down an Iranian plane back in 1988, killing about 290 people on board. And that was during the Iran-Iraq War. And the U.S. later admitted that it was a tragic and regrettable accident. I'm wondering if that at all are on people's minds as we're talking about what happened just last week.
Well, I think it should be just from this point of view. And I'll make a kind of a rare kind of a bit of moral clarity, if possible. You have these people belligerently yelling at each other, firing rockets at each other and so on. And, you know, who suffers the consequences? Innocent civilians. And it's happening over and over again. And, you know, maybe the leaders of both the United States and Iran and the Gulf states and the other and the Arab states in the region just have to recognize that it's just too tight of a planet for these kinds of games. And there's no way of having these kind of 19th century style imperial brinksmanship type conflicts without bringing completely innocent civilians into it. They're the ones who pay the cost. They are the ones who paid the cost when the U.S. Navy accidentally shot down the plane in 1988, and they're the ones who paid the cost when the Iranian armed forces accidentally shot down a plane in 2020.
That's Borzu Daragahi. He is the international correspondent for The Independent, speaking with us from Istanbul. Borzu, thank you.
Thank you so much.
According to the global research firm YouGov, one of the top 10 resolutions for 2020 was to be more spiritual. And to illustrate that, they used an icon of a person meditating, not praying. All this week, we'll be taking a closer look at secular spirituality. It's not religion. We have deep respect for people's faiths, their choice of a personal God, and a set of agreed-upon tenets. But you can be religious and still yearn for more connection with the human spirit. And according to the Pew Research Center, more Americans now say they are SBNR, spiritual but not religious. Maybe you've seen that on dating sites. Then there are the nuns. When asked religious affiliation, they say none. There's a yearning for a deeper way to live and to interact with people we disagree with. In other words, for a way to be more like Krista Tippett.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being.
Krista is creator and host of Radio's On Being, which has become, as The New Yorker said, a full-blown, multi-armed cultural institution. The On Being Project, the Civil Conversation Project, people with opposing views speaking with Krista. There's also the People's Suppers, communities with opposing views dining together. We'll link you up at herenow.org. It's pretty amazing. And Krista launches our series today from her mothership in Minneapolis. Krista, so nice to speak with you.
Well, thank you.
And how would you describe spirituality?
To me, the root meaning when we speak about spirituality is interior life.
Last year, scientists at Yale and Columbia said that they located the spiritual part of the brain not necessarily activated by religion. There's a region of the brain you can see where people's religious feelings light up their brain. But they said you can also see spirituality. This is when people turn their attention to themselves or other people. Spiritual experience can be a feeling of communion with God, but it also can be a feeling of being one in nature, or when one embraces humanity, it can be as simple as being elated during sporting events. So,
which just also, again, points at how broad this is.
Right.
And I love the way you're framing this series that you're doing, because we are a culture that has for a while now really only rewarded and privileged exterior accomplishment. Not too long ago, just about everyone had some religious identity that they inherited, like they inherited their hometown and their hair color.
9 in 10 Americans.
9 in 10. And that may have been a good experience. It may have been a bad experience. But there was a place given to each of us where reflection was invited. It's hard to carve out space for it, right, in the way we live now.
Young people in particular are making the politics their religion or work their religion, spin class, their church. What are you hearing?
The original report from Pew that coined this phrase, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, it was still a very, very tiny percentage of people who said that they don't believe in anything. You know, we've had a huge inflow of young people into the media listening space that is On Being in recent years. And I experience that, especially among some of the people who call themselves nuns, there is a real spiritual curiosity. I would say a very passionate desire to be of service, which in my mind, I kind of liken the nuns to the early monastic movements, because the monastic movements were spiritual renewal movements around the edges of religion that they experienced to have grown cold and to have grown distance from the deepest reasons it had come into being. And so I even see, you know, that people who don't identify explicitly with traditions are calling themselves, and in some sense, the traditions back to really go back to their core.
Interesting. One of the scientists at Yale, again, who found that the spiritual experience lives in the parietal cortex of our brain. They see it light up. They define a spiritual experience as being a robust state. You've spoken to so many scientists, neuroscientist Richard Davidson, botanist Robin Kimmerer. What do they say to you about spirituality?
The questions that the new technologies like brain imaging and just the way we're understanding the ecosystem of the natural world, for example, they are now illuminating our understanding of ourselves in a way that used to be reserved for theology. So I see scientists as really deep companions in these ancient animating existential questions.
Einstein saw wonder and reverence for mystery.
They're so much more fearless about using the word mystery than most of the religious people I know.
Well, speaking of a religious person you know, one of those popular episodes you've done featured John O'Donohue. He was a former priest and spoke about beauty and nature as a way to access the spiritual.
Yeah.
And here, I just want to listen to a little. He's drawing on his childhood in County Clare, Ireland.
I often think that the forms of the limestone are so abstract and aesthetic, and it is as if they were all laid down by some wild, surrealistic kind of deity, like a huge, wild invitation to extend your imagination.
We're talking about stones there, you know, yes. And suddenly, you know, we're plunged.
I don't know if you know the work of Dacher Keltner at Berkeley. So he's really delving into the notion of awe. And not only is awe a real thing, awe is a life-giving, health-giving thing, which I think is fascinating. Awe would be a term that most of us would, I think, historically have associated with belief in God. But when I look at his research and how people describe the experience of awe, so much of it overwhelmingly is about an experience of being in the natural world. And it's so interesting that we're getting in touch with that in the same moment that the natural world is changing, and something like weather that's been something of small talk that we've taken for granted is suddenly the stuff of the news.
And what about in this time in history when people want to hold on to their spirituality, which they may also define as their goodness? And yet, they may be very, very angry at someone on the other side of the partisan divide. I'm thinking when you spoke with poet and playwright Claudia Rankine about race, she says, I spent a lot of time thinking about how can I say this so that we can stay in this car together and yet explore the things that I want to explore with you. What have you learned about bridging these divides?
We're kind of in this stuck in outrage, which is actually terrible for us, right? I mean, we talked about awe a minute ago. It's the absolute opposite of that. Mm. And I'm sure they could demonstrate the terrible effects on our health and well-being. We're trained to fight and we're trained to wield our opinions. And, you know, let's just not accept that these chasms are forever, right? Mm.
This is one of your projects. You get people to sit down and talk about their opposing views. We want to listen to a little. The topic is abortion. You ask each side what they don't like about their side. And let's start with anti-abortion activist David Gushee.
What the main activists in the pro-life or anti-abortion community want is an overturn of Roe versus Wade. I am not at all convinced that if that were to actually happen, that they would like the world that they would see, because I'm not sure that it would lead to fewer abortions. I think it might lead to more.
Then we hear from Frances Kissling. Now, she didn't like when the pro-choice side dismissed the fetus.
I think fetuses have value, and I don't think you can make the fetus invisible in the abortion decision. Mm-hmm. What I like about the position of people who are very strongly opposed to legal abortion is that side of that movement that really is troubled.
There are many, many callings for this time. And yes, there are people who are going to be on front lines of battling. And there's also room for some of us to be calmers of fear. And there's a room for some of us to be bridge people, to start widening that space in the middle between the poles that are in a battle that they can't get out of. Letting yourself take as seriously what you care about and what you love and what you want your children to be seeing, and factor that in to the equation of how you live in this moment. A spiritual move would be, can I get as clear and as passionate about what I love, and how do I work towards that, even in very subtle ways?
I want to hear just a little bit of another, you know, beloved episode of On Being. This is Brené Brown, research professor at the Grad School of Social Work at the University of Houston, and she's talking about the spirituality of relationships, how you can speak to other people when we've tucked ourselves into ideological boxes, which has caused a lot of loneliness.
When you are really struggling with someone, and it's someone you're supposed to hate because of ideology or belief, move in, get curious, get closer, ask questions, try to connect. Remind yourself of that spiritual belief of inextricable connection. How am I connected to you in a way that is bigger and more primal than our politics?
Krista Tippett?
The wise people I speak with will say, you know, we're in relationship with that person on the far side of whatever vexes us. And I think that that is the kind of challenging insight that the spiritual traditions invite us to. We are defined as much by how we treat our enemies as by how we treat our friends. That is working on us from the inside and shaping our character. And so really doing this hard, messy, uncomfortable work of figuring out how you're going to be humane in the presence of people who feel like enemies, and I'm not talking about people who are going to hurt you. That is work that is also about your soul. That's just a huge thing to chew on and kind of walk through a lifetime with.
Darn it.
Exactly.
Krista Tippett, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
With all the news about impeachment and Iran, you can be forgiven if you didn't notice that the stock market is near all-time highs. On Friday, ever so briefly, the Dow Jones Industrial Average surpassed 29,000 during trading, a record that came despite those tensions with Iran, and a survey from Deloitte showing 97% of chief financial officers think there will be an economic downturn this year. So how to decipher these mixed signals as you make your financial decisions in 2020? Jill Schlesinger has given that some thought. She's business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money, and our weekly visitor. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And how do you read these signals from the stock market? Yay, but from CFOs who are worried?
I think cautiously. And I think what's really interesting is that really does plug into the two sides of each of us as investors and human beings, which is we want to think about the best case. That's ideal, right? Good times will keep coming, but we can't help that at these times where we are making new all-time highs or that you get a good jobs report, that you start to say, well, how long could this go on? It should change soon, right? And we've got to be balanced in our approach.
Yeah, well, and you said it before, so let's say it again. People want to try to time the market. They want to ride the wave up and then try to get out before things head south, you say.
No, come on.
Don't do that.
Don't do it. You know, look, I think that what's amazing to me is that when you try to time the market, you essentially have to make two perfect decisions, when to get out, but then also when to get back in. And I get that it's so alluring. I mean, you want to be that person, or at least hire the financial professional who knows the exact moment. But what we know is that over time, it's nearly impossible. Most of the time when you make a good market timing decision, it happens by accident. Mm-hmm. Oh, I had to sell this in order to buy my house, or I had to do something because of what was going on in my real life. So let's get that off the table. You actually don't have to be a market timer to be a successful investor or just successfully navigate different choices in your financial life.
Yeah, the thing about the stock markets is write it out, write it out, write it out. You always tell us, you always tell us. And by the way, I'm going to throw you a curve. What do you think? I mean, I however many years ago it was, hey, how could anybody think that, what was it, pets.com or something with the sock puppet that had no, you know, wasn't making any money? How could we think that that was worth investing in? And then it was, how could we think that those horrible loans, you know, those terrible home loans, that they were going to last? Do you have a sense of what it might be now?
Well, you know what? There's a lot of theories on what it would be now. But here's the good news. You don't have to identify what it is now. Here's what I can guarantee you. The good times will not last forever. There will be a recession. There will be a bear market.
How can you prepare for it? You could simply take steps that will see you through bad times. So right now, it's the beginning of the year. Did you look at your retirement account last year? Have you made sure that things are in balance the way you feel comfortable? Mm-hmm. Are you actually looking towards the future and investing or making a decision with a goal in mind? These are the things that definitely will keep you on track.
In other words, a mix of stocks and other things. Yes. How about taking some cash out if you think there's going to be a recession?
First of all, you don't know when the recession's going to be, right. Ms. Rob, and I know that you think you do.
No, I
and
don't.
All of you listening, you don't know when it's going to be either. Here's the thing. If you need money within the next year, free up that money. Tuition, home down payment, do that now. Don't look back. Do not try to time the market.
Jill Schlesinger, that's it. Business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill and Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
The Oscar nominations were announced this morning in Los Angeles, and leading the way was Joker with 11 nods, including Best Picture, closely followed by 1917 and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with 10 each. New films, but a little deja vu, at least when it comes to the makeup of the acting nominees. 19 of the 20 are white. Joining us to talk about all of this is John Horn, host of the KPCC show, The Frame. And John, give us your first impression of this year's nominees.
Well, I will say it started well, and that is actor-producer John Cho and producer, actress, and writer Issa Rae made the nominations. And that was about as diverse as the Oscars were.
Yeah.
It was all downhill from there. I mean, a couple of notable things. There are 20 acting nominations, if you count actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress. One person of color, Cynthia Erivo, who played Harriet Tubman in Harriet, was nominated. And if you look more closely at some of the categories, Greta Gerwig was not nominated for directing Little Women. And there were a number of other slights in different categories. The Academy has really wrestled with the idea of Oscars so white. They've tried to diversify their membership. And yet the results, to me, were invisible this morning.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about the nominees. You mentioned Greta Gerwig did not get nominated for director for Little Women, but Martin Scorsese did for The Irishman.
Well, I think that's kind of typical of the way things went. If you start looking closely at the films that were nominated for Best Picture, almost all of them outside of Little Women was made by a white guy. Ford versus Ferrari, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Marriage Story, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The one outlier outside of Little Women is Parasite, which was directed by Bong Joon-ho, the Korean filmmaker. And I think the real notable absence in this category is The Farewell, a great movie from Lulu Wang, which not only wasn't nominated for Best Picture, Awkwafina, the star of the film, I think everybody suspected that she was going to be nominated for Best Actress. She wasn't either. No member of the cast from The Farewell or Parasite was nominated in any acting category.
And that is also remarkable because Awkwafina won a Golden Globe.
Well, Awkwafina has won a lot of awards. And while predicting Oscar nominations is a very inexact science, if you look back, and I did this morning, the people that a lot of these prognosticators thought would be nominated didn't make it. And some of them were people that were kind of surprising, like Taron Egerton, who played Elton John in Rocketman, didn't make the cut. But if you start looking more closely, a lot of the people who didn't get nominated were people of color. Jamie Foxx from Just Mercy, Lupita Nyong'o from Us. I mentioned the actors from The Farewell. I mentioned the actors from Parasite. Jennifer Lopez from Hustlers. A lot of people thought she would be nominated.
Yeah.
And instead, you had people like Kathy Bates, who was nominated for supporting actress from Richard Jewell. Nobody saw that coming. And some really good performances, like Florence Pugh, one of who plays Amy in Little Women. A lot of people didn't think she would make the cut. She did. So there were some good performances that got in, but one out of 20 of the acting nominees was a person of color.
Wow. You know, I mean, we've been talking about Oscars so white for what feels like so long, several years now. What is the disconnect, you think, between the nominating committee and what we see and what the general public believes is a noteworthy movie?
It's a complicated question, but here's the shorter answer. When I was a film writer at the LA Times, along with a bunch of colleagues, we spent a year investigating the membership of the Academy. And this report came out in 2012. We found that it was 94% Caucasian, 77% male, and the median age was 62. Once you're in for life. It's kind of like the mob. You don't get kicked out. So all of those members, unless they die, stay in. So even as the Academy has invited hundreds upon hundreds of newer, younger, more diverse members, you have 6,000 members who represent kind of an older generation. So it's very hard to move that. And I guess if you look more closely at some of the nominations, a movie like Parasite, which if it wins the Best Picture Oscar, will be the first foreign language movie ever to do so. I think Bong Joon-ho is going to win the Oscar for directing it. That's the kind of movie that maybe five, certainly 10 years ago, wouldn't be in the race. So I think Parasite is a reflection of the changing demographics of the Academy. But if you start looking at other selections, like Quentin Tarantino, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Joker, which led with 11 nominations, those movies, to me, represent kind of the old guard, old way of kind of traditional thinking and very traditional movies.
I want to talk with you about the one woman of color nominated, British actress, as you mentioned, Cynthia Erivo. She was nominated for playing Harriet Tubman, an enslaved woman who led dozens of others to freedom in Harriet. Let's listen to a scene where she responds to concerns that she doesn't have the skills to help others escape.
Don't you tell me what I can't do. I made it this far on my own. God was watching, but my feet was my own. Running, bleeding, climbing, nearly drowned, nothing to eat for days and days, man. I made it. So don't you tell me what I can't do.
Other nominees for Best Actress, Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story, Saoirse Ronan for Little Women, Charlize Theron for Bombshell, Renee Zellweger for Judy. Your thoughts and the significance of Cynthia Erivo. I know that she actually turned down performing at the British Academy due to the lack of diversity among those nominees.
I think it's a great performance. It's a movie that got pretty good, not great reviews. I think it's a remarkable performance. I think she was also nominated for Original Song because she is that talented this year. I mean, it's an amazing story. The great thing about Harriet Tubman is that Frederick Douglass is like a background player in this story. It's a remarkable story that, even though it's set a long time ago, feels remarkably contemporary about standing up for what you believe in and risking your life. And Harriet Tubman not only was an abolitionist, she rescued slaves repeatedly at great peril. It's a remarkable piece of history. It's amazing that it hasn't been told in a movie before. So it's totally deserving. But it is, as you mentioned and as we've talked about, the outlier. It's the only actor of color who's nominated. And I guess maybe there's a parallel between what Harriet Tubman was fighting for, which is treat us all as equals and that we are no different from what is happening in Hollywood today.
In addition to the talk about diversity or the lack thereof in this year's nominations, there was also a lot of talk about the influence of Netflix. How did that play out in this year's Oscar nominees?
I think it played out well. I mean, Netflix has, you know, three movies that are in contention, The Irishman, Two Popes, and Marriage Story. And certainly the fact that they are in the race for Best Picture with Irishman and Marriage Story, I think is a very good sign. I still think right now, if you were handicapping things, you would say, and it sounds a little surprising because I would have said Jojo Rabbit a couple of weeks ago, 1917 is a movie that's coming on really strong and I think has a really good chance of winning Best Picture. I think Bong Joon-ho is going to win for director. So, yes, Netflix is well represented. I think it might be hard for them to win more than one or two Oscars, but the fact that they are competing with, you know, Warner Brothers and Sony and Paramount, I think is a sign of how things have changed, not just in the Oscars, but certainly in the Emmys as well.
Yep. And no host this year again. Your thoughts, good or bad for the show?
It worked well enough last year. I mean, why change something? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. They obviously were forced into that decision based on the multiple problems they had with last year's show and Kevin Hart. I think it worked well last year. It's a thankless job. I don't know anybody who's done it that well in recent memory. So why not? It's still inexplicable to me why this show is more than 3 hours long, but maybe they'll figure out a way to speed it up. Remember last year they tried to put some categories in commercial breaks, yep, and that didn't go over well, so they're kind of stuck. And I don't know how they're going to speed it up, but let's hope they do that somehow this way. But again, the story of this year's Oscars is going to be Oscars so white. Again, Oscars almost completely white except for one person.
We've been talking Oscar nominees with John Horn, host of the KPCC show, The Frame. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. The Oscars are on February 9th. Let's see what happens then.
And by the way, Cynthia Erivo is up for another Oscar for Harriet. She co-wrote this song, Stand Up, with Joshua Brian Campbell and performs it as well.
I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders, a bullet in my gun.
A question: where should registered child sex offenders be able to live? It's a question that is center stage in an Illinois courtroom today. A group of men in Aurora, Illinois, about 40 miles outside Chicago, could face felony charges if they don't move out of their home by Wednesday. It's a legal fight over housing and redemption. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
In downtown Aurora, McCarty Park takes up a full square block. There are walking paths, a fountain-like splash pad in the center of the park, and two small rocking horses further back. A couple of blocks away is Wayside Cross Ministries. It's a Christian-based group that's been around for decades and provides shelter and faith-based rehab services for people who are struggling with all sorts of problems, including transitioning from prison. 90 men live at one of the organization's buildings. 18 of them are registered sex offenders. And whether they live too close to the park has been a recent source of conflict between the mission and the city.
My name is Marcus. I am 48 years old.
Marcus Sabo served 2 years in prison after he was convicted of possessing child pornography. As he leads the way into the building, Sabo points out the library, a chapel, and some classrooms. He's been at Wayside Cross for 5 years and is now on staff. He says the structured program for men, with its daily Bible classes, religious services, and work assignments, transformed him.
Therapy didn't help, medications didn't help, even being locked up and, you know, so-called corrections, you know, didn't help anything. It wasn't until I came here and started reading what the Bible said, and seeing what Christ has done for me, that, you know, my mind started to wake up and completely changed my life since I've been here.
But now he may have to move. Last month, Aurora's police chief sent letters to Sabo and most of the others telling them they are in violation of the state's residency law. That law makes it illegal for convicted child sex offenders to reside within 500 feet of a school, a daycare center, or a playground. And the city says that includes McCarty Park. The letter came with a deadline. It said if the men aren't gone by January 15th, this Wednesday, they could face felony charges. Sabo says he was shocked because he's never had any problem registering before, and he and the other men fear they will be homeless. In recent months, the mayor of Aurora and some residents criticized Wayside Cross when it provided housing for an infamous convicted murderer who completed his prison term. The city says that protest has nothing to do with this latest scrutiny. Instead, it blames faulty measurements. Police Chief Kristen Zeman says the city realized its old mapping system measured some boundaries incorrectly. So last spring, they made corrections and took another look at Wayside Cross.
That is when we determined that the people who were living there were actually near a playground.
I don't think that having two little rocking horses that are used for kids converts an entire broad park with benches and lawns and picnic tables into a playground that's solely for children's recreation.
Attorney Adele Nicholas represents the 18 men and says the city is misrepresenting the state's residency law. The city says the distance from the men's housing to McCarty Park's property line is 500 feet. Nicholas says any measurement at the park should start where the fountain and rocking horses are located, and the distance would then be 550 feet. It's a mathematical squabble with profound implications, But Nicholas says another Illinois law protecting religious freedom is also at play, since the men are part of a community where daily religious services and Bible studies are paramount.
And forcing them to move out of that would disrupt those programs, disrupt the progress they're making through their faith.
Even so, if the men aren't out by the 15th, Kane County State's Attorney Joe McMahon could charge them with a felony. He seems reluctant.
People need somewhere to live. They need a safe place to live. The work that they've done there at the mission has been remarkable for really for decades. And we've got to find a way to resolve this where the people who use that park on a daily, weekly basis, especially during the warmer months, can use it and feel safe and comply with state law as well.
The 18 men who live at Wayside Cross Ministries say regardless of what happens to their request for a temporary restraining order to halt an ouster from their home, they'll push for a final ruling that makes clear how distance should be measured and where convicted sex offenders in Aurora can reside. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Aurora, Illinois.
And you heard her on NPR's Here and Now. One last story to note. In remote Alaska, a man who survived for about 3 weeks in sub-zero cold is now talking. Alaska state troopers found 30-year-old Tyson Steele late last week next to a makeshift shelter and a big SOS sign stamped in the snow. He told KTUU-TV in Anchorage he woke up to find his cabin on fire. He got out. His dog did not. Horrible to watch. The fire destroyed his home, most of his supplies.
I sat down on the ground for a while, like, just, it was cold, right? I didn't have any socks in my boots, and I was just wearing pajamas at that point and a t-shirt.
Well, after not hearing from Steele, friends and family asked state police to check on him. He'd been living alone in the wilderness about 50 miles southwest of Denali since September. He says he will rebuild. Some resilience to end the hour. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
In exploring secular spirituality, we're going to turn to literature. What themes should we include?
The things that help us live life with more meaning, with more purpose. Mm. And if I had a secular Bible, it would be this one book. Mm.
Which book is that? We'll tell you and give you a list of others that will inspire and instruct next time, Here and Now.